Session number 12709, Albert Davis, Reel 6.
Mr. Albert Davis, Reel 6. Were there any parachute scares, Mr. Davis?
On the beaches? No. The only parachutes I saw was what German planes had been shot down, or in some cases British Spitfire pilots come down. But whichever it was, they were soon captured and taken over by somebody. They were no problem. But there was, I can't say that there's any threat of airborne paratroops.
Did you get much opportunity for leisure?
Well, yes, we sort of, our leisure was all built around us. You know, we didn't have to go far for leisure. In any case, all we were interested in, perhaps a couple of pints of beer at night and maybe a chat with women, and that was about it. As long as we got cigarettes, pint of beer, we were quite happy.
Was there much in the way of...
There was dance organised occasionally. Even so, a lot of lads still didn't go to dances. They'd just rather have a good quiet pint of beer.
Were there any relationships taking up with local ladies?
Not as far as I was concerned, no. Possibly some, yes. Odd one. Because you've got that in most places where one would meet somebody and eventually get married to them. It's like they did at Wellington, Tiverton, Columpton. All different ones got married down in them places. My friend Tommy Ross, for instance, Clonton, Dougie Rory, he was Clonton, Ted Curry, Wellington, Somerset. There's quite a few that found girls who suit the soul and married down there. And they still live down there. So it must suit them, all right.
Did you get any sport?
Yes. Pretty well. Football, cricket, whatever was the height at that time. I was more for football myself. I played once or twice for the battalion. But plenty of football. Rugby I wasn't so keen on. I got lost two teeth in that. And cricket I wasn't keen on. No, I'd play to make the team number up, but I wasn't enthusiastic about it.
Most of these would be inter-unit games, were they?
Yes, yeah. You'd pick units from, say, a different regiment as well, a match with them. But wherever we went, we weren't there very long. As soon as you sort of settled down nicely, then you were beginning to get fraternised and know everybody, just as you get to settle down nicely. Uproots, we're on the move again.
And where was
that? Was the army trend. They didn't let you settle down long enough to get familiar. Just as you're trying to get familiar, or thought you were, right, packing up, off we go.
When was your next move?
Let me think. Oh, wait a minute, I've overrun that a bit, because... before we went down south, we went to a place called Rugeley in Staffordshire, at the Pit Heads, where we could take a bath and in tents there, and from there we got the leave. So I've overrun that, really. Well, Rugeley should have come before Abbotsbury, because it's after Rugeley, and after we'd had some leave, that we went to Abbotsbury.
When you were at Rugeley, as I said, the battalion had split in France just after Arras, yeah. And you would have men, of course, coming together again at Rugeley. Was there any stories or any explanation as to how and why they'd split?
No.
Some of them had come off at Boulogne, as you would come off at...
Yes, they did, yes. Some came from Boulogne and... well, you know, I heard all sorts of things, but you didn't know whether it was true or not. But at Rugeley, I know, after we came back off leave, then there was quite a few new faces joined us. That's where the new faces did join us. And there was Ken Kerslie, or even Durham's from different battalions, Scots lads, all sorts joined to make up the... In fact, at one time, it was on the balance, they told us that it was going to be vice versa, they were going to split the Durham's up and send them to different regiments. And there was a big bit of a rumpus over that, because the Durham lad said, no way are they going to serve in a Scottish regiment. And I think the authorities must have got hold of this and thought twice about it, and I don't think they would have done either. You know, I can't say that I would have been pleased to go to a Scottish regiment or any other regiment if it come to that. So they had to build the Durham's up again to full strength. But there was a strong rumour. Of course, rumours are rumours.
So there was no kind of animosity between the two groups that had split up?
Oh, no.
Who was commanding the battalion at this time?
Our battalion, if I remember right, I think it was Colonel Battiscombe. I think it's Colonel Battiscombe. Colonel Watson came later on.
He must have took over from Colonel Miller. Was there any reason given as to why Colonel Miller had gone and Colonel Battiscombe had come in?
I don't know. As that part didn't interest me. You know, we very often heard say, well, a new colonel's taking over, and, well, that's just another thing. We always say, well, whoever it is, there'll be no improvement. So that didn't bother us. In fact, I wasn't interested in how many colonels took over. The only colonel I didn't like was Colonel Yates. I thought he was a bad myself. I won't tell you what I thought.
Going back to the southwest of England, Mr. Davies, how was the battalion positioned on the beaches?
Well, the battalion was split up into companies, and each company would have a section of beach, and that was, of course, split up into sections, divided right down to sections of probably 9 men. And each company would have a different part of the beach to look after, so you were only interested in the part that you were allotted. Say perhaps couple of 300 yards or 500 yards a beat per section. So it was plenty to keep close guard on.
And you were a rifleman at this stage?
Yes.
What was your platoon or section number?
I haven't a clue.
You're still with C Company?
Yes, still with C Company, yes. I know the commander was Lieutenant Black then. He's still the same commander.
When did you move from the beaches?
Well, we were only on the beaches about, I should think, about a fortnight or 3 weeks, no more.
Where did you go to?
This is where we went to, southwest, Uppington. Each company again went to different places. Our particular one went to Uppington. One went to Wellington, one went to Taunton, one went to Clumpton, Honington, and all around the area. But several lads met girls there and married them.
Was the equipment position improving?
Yes, slowly. Slowly we were getting built up bit by bit. But it was a slow process. You know, one section would get certain articles, and then another section gets certain articles. But we built up slowly until the final build up was when we left there. And we went to Castle Bromwich. There. We had all new transport, Castle Bromwich, and all new equipment altogether. It was right new start.
What time was this? What date was this?
I can't tell you the dates without I look back through the books. But it's prior. It was a week prior to when we boarded ship at Gourock for the Middle East. And we knew we were going to the Middle East. We were told that before. And that's why we were told we were going to Castle Bromwich to re-equipped with all new equipment.
Before we reach that
and
point,
that's when the particular S Company started, so what they call Specialist Support Company. Now, we learned mortars and a tank and any other equipment outside the field of the infantryman like, so that we, whatever was wanted, we could take over and use.
So you were moved into S Company?
Yes. We were formed as an S Company then, Specialist Company.
And you had, you said, mortars, anti-tank?
Anti-tank. I was still with the anti-tank then. But we got 2-pounder anti-tank guns issued to us. There was 4 2-pounders.
And what were they like as a weapon?
Very nice little gun, I thought. But accurate, but not quite heavy enough for against the German armour. They wouldn't penetrate the tanks at all. Apart from Italian tanks they may do, or some of the lighter German tanks. But heavy tanks they wouldn't penetrate at all. But I thought, I liked the gun myself. What we did do, for the carrier platoon, we put a Bren gun, clamped it to the 2-pounder barrel in the desert, this, and aligned the sights of the Bren gun with the hairline of the telescopic 2-pounder gun, and at 1,000 yards you could hit a tin can with a burst of machine. At 1,000 yards you could watch these tracers go straight through this tin. By the time it's finished, there was no hole in, no bottom in the tin can, you know, an ordinary fruit can, because it stopped the vibration, and it was dead accurate. And they used that gun in the desert for raids. And why they didn't continue with it, I don't know. Probably it's because they couldn't get the clamps, or it was too long. But they could have done the same method with armoured cars, anything. Align the sights up. Instead of looking through the sights of a machine gun, look through the sights of the main gun. You know, the cross wires. Much more accurate. Because you knew you got it straight up instead of that way. Straight up and straight across.
What was the crew of a 2-pounder anti-tank gun?
Crew of four. Plus a Lance Corporal. Three, actually, plus a Lance Corporal.
And what were the designated duties of each man?
Designated?
Duties. What was the duty of each man on the gun?
Well, there was a commander, or tell him when to fire, as the relay man, the loading operator, and the firing operator. So it's a little team sort of thing.
And there was a trained routine for firing.
There was a sergeant in charge of each gun. And they selected the time to fire. No, not let lads were inclined to fire too soon, instead of letting them get closer and making sure. Mind you, sometimes it didn't always pay off, because they knew the tanks would outrange our guns, 2-pounders. They got twice the range as what we got. So they could fire further away at us or what we could at them. So the thing we had to do is try and keep dead quiet and still until they were well within range to make sure you got him. Because once you hit him, they stop dead. I've never seen a tank yet, but once you hit it, it's dead, whether you pierced him or not. Because they don't know what's hit. They can feel it inside the tank, and they don't know what's hit them.
There would be a certain routine for firing, a firing routine which would be trained, you'd be trained to do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What form did that take?
when you say routine, it's really left to the sergeant in charge, say, when to fire. You know? Although this lad got his eye through the aperture, he got his laid on, like. He wouldn't allow him to fire until he thought that was well within range. Then he'd say, fire.
So the aimer would get the target lined up, and then he would tell the sergeant that he was laid on?
Yes, yeah.
And then he had to wait for the order to fire?
Yes, yeah. And you get some itchy fingers. Wanted to fire when they're way out of range, and well, you're just asking for trouble.
What was your particular job on the gun?
Well, as I was, had a gun of my own, and then I became troop sergeant. So that was included all the four guns. My job was to get all these four guns sighted in various places where I thought would do most good. You know, where the guns were wanted. If an officer of the infantry came to me and said, "Sergeant, can I have an anti-tank gun on the right of my section?" And I'd say, "Yeah, well, I'd go and have a look at this." And if I thought he was right, I'd say, "Yes, right, I'll get one of my guns up." And that's different sections had a gun, or whoever applied for aid. If they didn't apply for aid, they still had them behind them anyway. You know, we'd still got to sight them wherever we were, ready for action. No, just because we weren't wanted at that particular minute, say, "Right, you stay there." You can't. You got to go up the front and get your gun into action. Doesn't matter. Well, sometimes a good sight, sometimes a bad sight. You couldn't always choose, or you hadn't got time to choose. It's a matter of speed was more essential than anything else.
If an officer asked for help for a gun and you felt that it wasn't necessary, had you the authority then to say no, you wouldn't be taking a gun?
Well, if an officer asked me for help, I wouldn't question him. I mean, there must be something in it if he's asked for help. I wouldn't question him. No, I'd say, right, if it was within my range, and I'd got a gun, I'd say, "Sure, I'll help you one. I'll fetch one."
How was the 2-pounder transported?
At first on a 1508, but then we had carriers to transport them. And that was good. And then we had what was called from carriers. They're all right, but carrier could only take one. Well, what we call it was a 30 hundredweight truck minus its body. Just a chassis, what they called a portee, an open truck. So you could get one on the truck itself, you could winch one onto the truck itself, and you could also tow one. So that was two crews and two guns on one portee. In actual fact, each one was loaded a portee on its own. But when it come to the crunch, you lost vehicles through mines, fire or engines, then you could transfer one gun onto another, double up all the time, which was pretty good.
Could you fire from a portee?
Yes, you could fire from a portee. Yeah. That's providing that your kit was out of the way. If the portee was packed right, which it should be from the start, you know, petrol there, water there, and everything's packed right, you should be able to fire from the portee as soon as you vaulted.
How much ammunition and shells did you carry with the gun initially, as a kind of initial a number to get you into action?
Well, anything from 50 onwards, 50 to 100 shells maybe. Whatever was available. It all depended on what we thought we were up against, you know. But we never ran out of ammunition. Not completely. We're very, very close by, but not completely.
What kind of a shell was it? Armoured piercing or...?
Armoured piercing. It was capable of firing HE shell. But we never had any HE shells issued. were solely anti-tank, which was armour-piercing shell. And with tracer shells. So you could follow the flight of the shell. And those good things, tracers. You know, you could have a gun on a truck below that fence. You could fire that gun over that fence without actually seeing the target, without the gun aimer seeing the target. That's what we did do. Use it almost as mortar. Because in the desert it's right open, as you know. But this is the way we used it. He couldn't see us. You might see the end of the barrel, but he couldn't actually see the vehicle. And we used it as mortar. The only thing about that was it took about five times as many rounds of ammunition as a direct sight. A direct sight, one or two rounds and you should have it. With using it as a mortar like that, you had to get it in line first and then creep up in range. And or get a plus, a minus, and then try and get. Well, it perhaps take you several rounds before you bang on target.
So one of you would be having to observe the shells falling and giving up.
Yes, I used to do that with, and tell him exactly. Fire shell for shell. They'd fire a shell at us, and we'd fire a shell back at them, and tell him exactly when to fire. I'd have to jump off the portee, load, chuck her around in her, jump back on again, fire a dog. Until we got it, in the end we got him all right. But you live and learn all the time. You learn something to your advantage all the time, you know. That's if you're lucky enough to be allowed to live to learn.
Coming back to the pride, just going abroad to the Middle East. Your training in the middle of the counties, not on the beaches, had that changed in some way from the activities you were doing on the beach? We'd taken part in bigger schemes and so forth.
We took part in schemes, yes. But schemes always seem to go wrong. Nothing ever seemed to go the way it wanted to. Well, and that's exactly the same as in battle. Nothing ever seems to go right. So, it really depends on the individually concerned and the teams. It was far better, I thought, it's far better having them in smaller groups and a group looking after a group. They'd fathom out their best way, and perhaps another group would fathom out their best way, and act with somebody, an officer or somebody, to push them. You've got to always have that bit of little extra push, you know. But given the confidence, you'd work better like that. You didn't require officers all the time then. You'd work on your own, and you knew what you'd got to do. And therefore the officers were happy and we were happy. There wasn't much difference in training though, apart from the lads that were always on put. They may have had a little bit more training, but they'd never alter that. You could only go at one pace. Well, let's see. You're expected to go at hell of a pace, but in the end it boiled down to the same thing, just one pace.
Had you received any promotions up to going abroad? Had you been promoted at all?
Yeah, I reached the rank, well, in fact I reached the rank of Staff Sergeant. I was Sergeant, then Staff Sergeant, But replacements, we had replacements. A sergeant major came, funny enough, same name as myself, Davis. And there was no room for a staff sergeant and a sergeant major and a sergeant. You know, you were limited to what ranks you could have. So, as it was only about a fortnight since I'd been made staff sergeant, I said, all right, I'll revert back to sergeant. And the sergeant major could revert back to staff sergeant. But he didn't, he kept his sergeant major. Although he was only paid for, he kept his rank, but he was only paid as a staff sergeant.
When did you get your first stripe?
To be honest, I can't tell you.
Was it while you were in England before you
in
went
England,
to
yes.
the Middle East?
Yeah, in England. I think it was... I don't know whether it's Uffcombe later on in Uffcombe, because the first... No, at Uffcombe I refused. My first stripe I refused to have. Later on then I accepted one, but it must have been after Uffcombe. Probably the Castle Blomage. After that, on board ship I was made corporal, full corporal. That's sailing from Gourock to the Middle East. And after we landed in the Middle East, I was made sergeant.